From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence heads home from Europe later today. He's been there since the weekend, trying to reassure leaders that the U.S. wants to deepen the U.S. relationship with Europe. But Pence is facing some tough questions about that because his boss, President Donald Trump, supported Brexit, the United Kingdom's vote to leave the European Union. Trump has also suggested the EU could fall apart and called Brussels, quote, a hellhole. Hoping to counter that, in Brussels today, Vice President Pence met with leaders of the European Council, the European Commission, and NATO.
It is my privilege here at the NATO headquarters to express the strong support of President Trump and the United States of America for NATO and our transatlantic alliance.
Joining us now from Brussels is the BBC's Europe reporter Gavin Lee. And Gavin, thanks for joining us. How has Mike Pence been received?
Well, he's clearly bridge building. He's clearly there smoothing relations in all of his remarks, and he's given one at the building of the European Council, where one of the main European Union buildings, and also at the NATO headquarters just across the city here in Brussels. And both of them were about saying that the US is committed to being steadfast and an enduring relationship with both the EU and NATO. Now, these words, forgive me, but actually go back a year or so, you'd think, not much difference to the Obama administration, but yet how different things are. This is the EU through the looking glass, because the backdrop to this is just a few weeks ago, for the first time in the history of the European Union, another Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, had said that the United States administration in the White House was one of the external threats to the future of the European Union, given the rhetoric and language they'd heard through Twitter in interviews with Donald Trump. Go back 3 weeks. So it's an interview in the Times newspaper in the UK where he described the EU as basically a vehicle for Germany, saying that Britain was so smart in getting out and that he wouldn't be too concerned if other countries went the same way. But as I say, those words were different today. And one of my colleagues at the BBC a short while ago asked the Vice President Pence, he said, this is all well and good that the US are declaring better relations with the EU and with NATO, but are you reflecting the words of your boss? And you know, are you on the same track? And he said, absolutely. I was sent here by Donald Trump today to give this message.
Well, as you point out, there are sometimes these conflicting messages, one through official channels and the other on Twitter or at rallies. Is it your sense the Europeans are buying his message of reassurance, or is there a lot of skepticism?
Well, I must say, actually, the sort of elephant in the room right at the start were these comments clearly made in the past by Donald Trump, and Donald Tusk made that clear. Actually, he said things aren't what they used to be here with EU-US relations, and that, I quote, recent and new surprising remarks were bringing to question the very relationship and the common security between us. So there was no sense of certainly EU leaders believing that this was as things were. The other point actually to make is there were some clear, when Mike Pence was pushed on where does he stand when it comes to the rhetoric used by Donald Trump, he did say, I made clear that the American government see there are differences between us and how the EU sees things, but we both share core values. And on he went after about an hour, 2 hours at the European Union headquarters to NATO across the city, in which a similar message to what we had from James Mattis, the Defence Secretary, last week, when he said that he wants to make sure there is unwavering support from the US to NATO, but up your game when it comes to spending more. In fact, the words today from Mike Pence were, if you don't have a plan to spend more on NATO, then get one. Basically, five of the 28 countries are spending, as required, 2% of their GDP. The rest don't meet that.
Well, the Trump administration is hardly the first U.S. administration to ask NATO members to pay more of their fair share. What are NATO officials saying in response?
Well, I think this may play in the favor, actually, of NATO HQ, because this is something, you're right, that the NATO top brass have been suggesting for quite some time. Jens Stoltenberg, who's the Secretary General of NATO, a short while ago said that he absolutely agrees with the American message. He would do anything to encourage other members to increase the amount they're paying. And in fact, since this First, rhetoric from Donald Trump months back. NATO say that they've had a pledges of $10 billion in the past few months. It still means there are only five countries meeting that target, but by the end of the year, Romania will, Lithuania and Latvia will by the end of next year, and Germany will be committed to meeting that potentially in the next 5 years, which is part of the agreement that was made. It takes a few years to do this. So I think on that issue, which was seen to be one that both were happy with, then there's the other big sort of ripple effect here, which is Russia, of course, and what happens in the Ukraine. Mm. Mike Pence declaring that the US will continue to make Russia accountable over its alleged involvement in the Ukraine conflict, and that today, the day that a ceasefire is due to be kickstarted in Ukraine after so many have failed since the Minsk peace agreement a couple of years ago, he's urging both sides to stick to that as well.
The BBC's Gavin Lee in Brussels. Gavin, thank you very much.
All the best.
Well, here in this country, more than 65,000 students now attend online charter schools. They're publicly funded and privately run, just like brick-and-mortar charter schools. But students access their teachers and lessons almost entirely online. Last year, virtual charter schools collected more than $1 billion in taxpayer money, and most of it went to 2 for-profit companies. But reports show virtual charter schools have been plagued by poor student outcomes and lawsuits. Online charter advocates promised things would go differently in North Carolina. But as Jess Clark of Here and Now contributor WUNC reports, the first-year test results are disappointing.
And that's what we're talking about today. Igneous rocks.
It looks a lot like Saturday morning at the Thompson household in Benson, North Carolina, a rural area south of Raleigh. Three girls sit in the kitchen, dressed in comfy sweats, each slouched in front of a glowing laptop. But this is 11 a.m. on a Monday, and while the Thompson girls aren't in a classroom, they are in school.
This is a less stressful situation because you kind of see how laid back they are. They're not being rushed to hurry up and finish this.
That's the girl's mother, Tammy Thompson. Last school year, she enrolled her three kids in North Carolina Virtual Academy, or NCVA, one of the state's two virtual charter schools. Thompson worked as a child nutritionist for 15 years in the local public schools. She says the environment felt unsafe, and she thought students weren't getting the attention they needed.
We had a foster child that lived with us, and I met her in the sixth grade at my school, and she couldn't even read, and nobody figured it out. I figured it out. She couldn't read. And she had made it all the way to the sixth grade, not reading.
At the breakfast table, 8-year-old Abigail Thompson clicks lightning fast through multiple choice math problems. She says kids picked on her in regular public school. The virtual experience, she says, is much better.
You don't have to get bullied, and you still can make friends.
Mm-hmm. Do you still make friends through your school?
When we have open chat, we can either chat to our friends through the chat box or through the microphone.
Not all virtual charter school students are doing as well as Abigail. The state's two virtual charters, NCVA and North Carolina Connections Academy, fell far short of expected student academic growth on state tests. In fact, the schools have the two lowest student growth scores in the entire state.
Are our scores what we wanted? They're not, but we're going to improve.
Joel Medley is the top administrator for NCVA. He says the school has added more staff and extra supports for students who struggle in math. When it comes to the low growth score, Medley says he looks at growth differently.
If you talk to those families, the statements that they are giving us about the schooling that they received this year compared to where they have come from, that's the difference. That's part of the growth. If you have students that are behind, you can't turn them around completely in 1 year. It takes time. And that's all that we're saying is give us the time with the 4 years.
4 years is the amount of time state lawmakers gave NCVA and Connections Academy to run. Lawmakers call it a pilot program. But pilot or not, the program makes for an expensive experiment. The schools receive just about as much per student as the state's traditional public schools and charters. In 2 years, they've collected more than $30 million. And they have more than 3,000 students statewide. Todd Zebarth is with the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. He says that's a lot of kids to have on the line in a pilot program.
Those numbers are probably too high, at least out of the gate. Why don't we see if these operators can succeed maybe with a few hundred kids?
Zebarth says he thinks the reason operators are starting out so big is because they want to make more money. After all, these are for-profit companies running these schools. Mark Jewell leads the state's largest teachers association, which opposed the opening of virtual charters.
When you have a track record of students that are not performing and you have companies coming in that are making a profit off of the work that's being done on the back of our students, that's troubling and very concerning for us as educators.
Despite the concerns of educators, virtual charter school operators continue to hold sway with state lawmakers. K-12, the company that manages NCVA, has five lobbyists registered at the North Carolina State House.
What great English explorer and sea captain, Sir Francis Drake. Sir Francis Drake.
The schools also have happy parents, like Tammy Thompson. Thompson says NCVA's for-profit nature doesn't bother her. Neither do its low test scores, even though one of her kids tested below grade level last year.
It doesn't bother you that the scores, the state scores are low?
No, the testing is not. I see what my kids do daily. That test does not say who my kids are.
Under the terms of the pilot program, the virtual charter schools can grow 20% each year, and both schools say they intend to do so. That means next year, the two schools could enroll more than 4,000 students in a program critics say is already underperforming. For Here and Now, I'm Jess Clark.
The Conservative Political Action Conference today announced that President Donald Trump will speak there on Friday. Over the weekend, CPAC, as it's called, made a similar announcement confirming another speaker, Milo Yiannopoulos, the controversial Breitbart editor and far-right commentator who is scheduled to address the conference this week. Yiannopoulos, who is openly gay, has made his name making provocative and often offensive comments about Muslims, women, transgender people, and others. But a video that surfaced over the weekend was a step too far for some. It shows Yiannopoulos condoning sexual relationships between adults and young teenagers on the Drunken Peasants podcast on YouTube.
People are messy and complex, and actually, in the homosexual world particularly, some of those relationships between younger boys and older men, the sort of coming-of-age relationships, the relationships in which those older men help those young boys to discover who they are and give them security and safety and provide them with love and a reliable and sort of a rock where they can't speak to their parents. Some of those relationships are some of the most...
It sounds like pre-molestation to me.
Yiannopoulos continued with more graphic language that we're not going to play on the air. When others on the podcast accused him of defending pedophilia, this is what he said.
You're misunderstanding what pedophilia means. Pedophilia is not a sexual attraction to somebody 13 years old who is sexually mature. Pedophilia is attraction to children who have not reached puberty.
Well, today, the American Conservative Union revoked the invitation to Yiannopoulos because of that video, but said in a statement, "We initially extended the invitation knowing that the free speech issue on college campuses is a battlefield where we need brave conservative standard bearers." They're referring to the University of California, Berkeley's decision earlier this month to cancel Yiannopoulos' appearance on campus following violent protests. Protesters said Yiannopoulos' words are hate speech and not free speech. Joining us now via Skype to talk about hate speech and how it's treated under the law is Margaret Russell. She's a professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
And is there a legal definition of hate speech?
There actually is not, and that may be surprising. However, the Supreme Court has actually taken a number of interesting cases in which it has looked at laws that have tried to define hate speech or otherwise curtail it by limiting it in other categories.
And what did they find in those cases?
Well, let me mention a couple of recent ones, even though the First Amendment speech jurisprudence is a long and interesting story that actually starts in the 19-teens during World War I. The basic principle that the Supreme Court has wrestled with under the Free Speech Clause is the principle of not punishing speech because of its message or its viewpoint. That in itself is a violation of the principles of the Constitution. But, for example, in certain areas like obscenity or child pornography or incitement to violence, the court has made exceptions based on the dangers that those impose. Hate speech has not been considered to be part of any of those categories in and of itself. So, for example, about 5 years ago, in 2011, the court decided a very famous case involving the Westboro Baptist Church, which it pickets at funerals and was on the sidewalk outside of a funeral, uttering words and carrying signs and badgering and using epithets, anti-gay epithets, and they were sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the Supreme Court said that it is not possible to take into account their viewpoint, their animus, their hatred, essentially, in punishing. And so that means that under the First Amendment, you really have to have another law regulating conduct that's broken. So, you know, if you are beating somebody up, obviously you can be charged with a hate crime if you're doing that with the intention of targeting them because of their race. But if you're walking beside that person on the sidewalk with a sign or handing out flyers that reflect hatred toward that race, that is protected.
So what you're saying is that there are limits on free speech. The Supreme Court has found in certain cases that there are limits on free speech, but none of the cases that have been brought actually involve what you would consider hate speech. That's not the reason why there's a limit.
Well, yes and no. The Supreme Court has looked at, but not defined, hate speech in a couple of cases. One of them actually is the Snyder versus Phelps Westboro Baptist Church case. In the area of race, ethnicity, St. Paul actually had passed in the 1980s what they called a bias-motivated crime ordinance. And this ordinance was specifically intended to allow someone to sue if they were the victim of hate speech. And the Supreme Court struck down that law because it singled out certain viewpoints, hateful viewpoints, and the Supreme Court said that the First Amendment does not allow that, although you can always craft a law that is applicable across the board. Let's say if you're assaulting someone or threatening them or harassing them, that's definitely conduct that's not protected under the First Amendment. But if you're punishing it because of the viewpoint, that is always unconstitutional.
Well, so then that brings up the question of where the line is drawn about if you're harassing somebody, if you get up and make a broad statement about a group of people and say, I think all of these people should die, is that hate speech? Is that harassing somebody? Or is it because it's to a broader group that it wouldn't be considered hate speech?
Well, certainly there are situations in which a person could be arrested, not for saying that, not for the message. And this is sort of where the subtler lines are drawn, but because of the presence of other factors. The Supreme Court has said, if someone is inciting violence. So regardless of viewpoint, if someone is speaking in a way and in a context in which they're encouraging violence that could be imminent and they are intentionally trying to bring that about, that is known as incitement, and that is not protected speech.
There's also a distinction, isn't there, when you're talking about one person in particular, fighting words?
Yeah, so fighting words is an interesting example of an area of law in which the case that defined it has not been overturned, but it hasn't particularly been followed very clearly. So fighting words in the 1940s in a Supreme Court case called Chaplinsky was defined as words that inflict immediate injury or tend to incite a breach of the peace. And fighting words has been used as the rationale for hate speech codes, hate speech regulations, on the basis of the argument that hateful words do inflict psychic, emotional, and sometimes lead to other kinds of injuries. But fighting words itself requires a face-to-face, a direct confrontation. It requires a setting and a set of facts that wouldn't apply across the board to regulating hate speech.
What about slander, saying a false statement that harms someone's reputation, and libel, publishing a false statement to harm someone's reputation, which are not protected under the First Amendment? How do they differ from what some might call hate speech?
There are several different areas of the law, including slander and libel, in which speech alone, because of the harm it does, can actually be regulated, right? And it's not because the viewpoint of the speech, it's because it damages injury, reputation, and it is factually false. Hate speech, most of hate speech that I'm aware of is, it's opinion. It may be despicable opinion, but they're not false statements of fact. And even hyperbole, such as saying, all blanks are pigs, all blanks are monkeys, right? That's considered to be hyperbole, and it's not an assertion of fact that could be the subject of a slander or a libel lawsuit.
How often do questions of hate speech get brought before the courts? How often does this make it all the way to a judge?
Since the most recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court, and by recent, I mean the so-called RAV versus City of St. Paul case in 1992, and a cross-burning statute case called Virginia versus Black, and then the Westboro Baptist Church case, I think the law is pretty clear, at least to the extent that hate speech is not considered by itself to be unprotected under the First Amendment. So if people want to enact laws or if people want to prosecute people who violate the law, the prosecution can't be based on the viewpoint of the person. It has to be based on the underlying crime.
The underlying crime that is not related to speech. The underlying crime, you're saying, being something that maybe happens because of the speech.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So even in fighting words, right, the reason why fighting words still exist to any extent, although it's not brought up as often, is because of the damage, not because of the particular words uttered, right? And if you think about hate crimes, and many jurisdictions do have hate crimes ordinances, according to the Supreme Court in Wisconsin versus Mitchell, have to punish a particular crime like assault or battery or threats, and then allow for an enhancement if the motive is to beat somebody up or commit the crime based on their race. I know that that sounds like such a one of those legal niceties, but the difference is basically that when you criminalize, consistent with the First Amendment, what you're criminalizing is the conduct.
Not the speech.
Not the speech.
That's Margaret Russell, who's a professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
It's President's Day, a day in which Americans remember the many leaders that have helped shape this country and get good deals on mattresses and cars. But we're going to take a few minutes on this President's Day to look back at the history of one of America's most famous songs.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of rain.
America the Beautiful was written in 1893 by the poet and scholar Catherine Lee Bates during a visit to Colorado. When I visited Denver in October, I met Elisa Phelps, director of the Collections and Library Division at History Colorado Center, who told us more.
Catherine Lee Bates was a professor. She was from Massachusetts, and she spent a summer teaching English in Colorado Springs. And at the end of the summer semester, she and some professor colleagues took a trip up Pikes Peak in a prairie wagon, if you can imagine that. And when she got to the top, just looking around at the vast expanse and the wide open sky, it gave her the inspiration to write America the Beautiful.
This was just a poem. It wasn't a song at the beginning.
Right. It was a poem, and it wasn't actually set to music until the early 1900s, or at least not to the tune that we think of it as today. The tune that we know was written by a gentleman named Samuel Ward, and he actually passed away before the poem and the music were put together. That happened in 1910.
The words were not always the words that we hear today in the song, right?
She revised it a couple of times. One of the big changes is some of the language that was used was more academic in tone. And the change in 1904 is much closer to the version that we know today. She revised it one more time after that.
Now, you've got the original America the Beautiful in front of you. Can you read it to us?
Sure. Oh, beautiful for halcyon skies, for amber waves of grain, for Purple Mountain Majesties above the enameled plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till souls wax fair as earth and air and music-hearted sea. O beautiful for pilgrim feet, whose stern impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till paths be wrought through wilds of thought by pilgrim foot and knee. Of beautiful for glory tale of liberating strife, when once or twice for man's avail men lavished precious life. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till selfish gain no longer stain the banner of the free. O beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years, thine alabaster cities gleam undimmed by human tears. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till nobler men keep once again thy whiter jubilee.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee.
Alisa Phelps of History Colorado Center reading America the Beautiful in its original form.
In January of last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Florida's death penalty was unconstitutional. Florida and a few other states at the time gave judges the final say in sentencing someone to death. But the High Court ruled that only juries can hand down the sentence. So when Florida lawmakers meet again next month, they'll have to write new sentencing rules. In the meantime, the state's death penalty is in limbo. No executions have been carried out, and cases involving the 383 inmates on death row are on hold. Wilson Sayre from Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami has been reporting on what all this means for the people on death row and their victims' families. In the first of two reports, she visited the last inmate to live in Cell 1, the cell Florida inmates stay in before they're executed.
Mike Lambrix has spent more of his life on death row than on the outside. Lambrix is 56. He's lost most of his hair along with his once athletic body. Every day for the 33 years he's lived on death row, he's worn the orange shirt of a condemned man in Florida. He was convicted of a double murder in 1984. And at the end of November 2015, Governor Rick Scott signed his death warrant. Mike Lambrix was set to die by lethal injection in February of last year. He was moved from death row to death watch. Death watch is reserved for people who've been given their execution dates.
The first thing you see is a board on the wall that says your name, your cell number, and your execution date. Every time you go in and out of there, you see that right there in writing just to remind you.
We talk in an interview room at Florida State Prison, an hour outside of Gainesville. Just outside, inmates were mowing the grass. On death watch, inmates get a lot more privileges than death row inmates. You get to call your family. Until recently, social calls weren't allowed on death row. Lambrix says the guards tend to be nicer. Even those that don't have a great reputation on death row show a more compassionate side on death watch. But death watch isn't supposed to be some kind of prison paradise where you can live out your final days in a more enjoyable setting. There's a practical side to it. Inmates are here so guards can watch over them more carefully, make sure they don't hurt themselves or hurt others. The fear is condemned prisoners have nothing to lose.
You never forget why it's different. Everything about death watch is specifically structured towards what the conclusion is going to be.
While Lambrix was on death watch, he had company, a guy named Oscar Bolin. Bolin's date came before Lambrix's. He was next to be executed. Bolin was in cell one.
He's going through his routine, I'm going through mine.
Preparing for their executions. Lambrix watched Bolin pack up his property in boxes.
Putting it up at the front gate for pickup by his wife.
Bolin had his final meetings with a lawyer and a chaplain. For Lambrix, this was like looking into the future.
I'm 10 feet away, so I'm really, you know, I can't get away. There's nowhere I can go. I put my earbuds on, you know, my MP3 is my escape.
As Bolin's appeals were denied, he became more anxious.
And then the day before the execution, he goes ahead and shaves his own chest because, you know, it's either you shave it or they shave it.
At 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the scheduled day in January of last year, the guards walk Bolin out through a door on death watch.
That looks like just a regular house door, but when you walk through that door, Now, then you go a little bit further, you go into the execution chamber.
The state's two execution chambers are right next to Death Watch. In one, there's the state's electric chair, which hasn't been used since 1999. In the other chamber, there's a gurney with straps used for lethal injections. And as Oscar Bolin was walked out, Lambricks could hear people on the other side of the door, witnesses to the execution milling about for hours.
Every little sound down on Death Watch during this period of time becomes somewhat amplified, like a thunderous roar. Every little whisper, you know, I'm straining to hear everything that goes on the other side of that door.
Listening for any news, like it's called off or rescheduled.
All of a sudden, it got very quiet. No more whispers, no more talking. And that's when we realized.
The execution was going ahead. Not long after, he heard people filing out. And it affected him. He'd gotten to know Bolin. They'd spent weeks talking between their cells, and then he's just down the hall during Bolin's execution.
You know, I didn't sleep too well that night. But one of the things that really bothered me about the process after they killed him is that very early the next morning, they came in and they ordered me to get my stuff in my cell 3, and I immediately got moved to cell 1. I mean, you know, I just tell myself, what, you couldn't wait a day? You know, you just killed this guy. You couldn't just wait a day? So I got moved from cell 3 to cell 1, and that brought my reality home.
The reality of cell 1. For the past 4 decades, this is the cell everyone who's been executed in the state of Florida has stayed in.
That is the last cell.
Were you scared at that point?
Not scared. It was the reality of it. Just a few hours ago, they killed the guy. And it's not just going into that cell. It's what that cell represents. When you walk into that cell 1, there's a part of you that even despite all the hope that you might still have, it takes that hope away.
This was the second time Lambricks had been in that cell. He was hours away from his execution before, in 1988. Being in cell 1 changes you, he says. You have to wrestle with knowing the date of your death. You have to deal with that along with the other more mundane things, like divvying up your property.
Like my MP3, my most favorite thing of all, I wanted my sister to have that because she could relate to all the kinds of music I have. And I wanted my son to have other things that are personal to me, like my watch a wallet that I had from way back. And you don't have a whole lot, but you try to figure out what would mean something to somebody else because you want to leave a part of you behind with them so that maybe it won't be forgotten.
Lambricks found himself making day-to-day choices based on the date of his execution. Should he buy new toothpaste or stretch what he has left? Watch the new X-Files miniseries on the TV in his cell? His date would come halfway through the episodes. He was fitted for his execution suit, dark blue with charcoal pinstripes, and a white t-shirt, short sleeves so they can insert the needle. All the while, Lambricks writes voraciously. When he talks, he tends to distance himself from his experiences. He says, you, not I. But in his letters and writings, we really get to hear what he thinks. He opens up in the first person.
January 2016. Time flies when you're counting down what is expected to be the last days of your life. But as I awoke this morning, I realized that I'm now down to 25 days. I smiled as I remembered a song on my MP3 player by country music legend Johnny Cash called 25 Minutes to Go. It starts with the words, they're building a gallows outside my cell, and I've got 25 minutes to go.
Well, they're building a gallows outside my cell, and I've got 25 minutes to go.
Then in his southern accent continues, the whole town's waiting just to hear me yell.
I got 24 minutes to go. Well, they gave me some beans for my last meal with 23 minutes to go. But nobody asked me how I feel. I got 22 minutes to go.
During each minute of his 25 days, Lambricks is hoping his execution will get called off.
The phone is like 5 feet in front of your cell, and you're just like looking at that phone and there's a clock on the wall and you're looking at that clock because that phone is your lawyer's telling you you've got a stay of execution. You know, every moment of that clock is tick, 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 and you're looking at that phone just trying to mentally will it to ring.
For Lambrix, a little more than a week before his execution, the phone did ring. The U.S. Supreme Court had issued a decision in a case called Hearst versus Florida. The Hearst decision said the way Florida handed down death sentences was unconstitutional because of who had the final say. Juries, not judges, needed to be the ones to hand down a death sentence. So for cases being tried now, they're on hold and we'll have to wait until the Florida legislature reconvenes and writes new rules about how to sentence someone to death. For inmates who've already been tried and sentenced, the courts are beginning to re-examine many of their cases to see if their sentence should still stand. What's going to happen to Lambrix is unclear. He still has a signed death warrant, and any day now, he could find himself back in cell one. For Here and Now, I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
Tomorrow, we meet two women whose loved ones were murdered in violent crimes and find out what they think and feel about the death penalty.
The new U.S. Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, is in Baghdad today on an unannounced visit as the fight against ISIS continues in Iraq. Secretary Mattis spoke to reporters today, commenting on the U.S. relationship with Iraq and its oil.
All of us in America have generally paid for our gas and oil all along, and I'm sure that we will continue to do so in the future. We're not in Iraq to seize anybody's oil.
The comment seems to be a departure from what President Trump has said about Iraqi oil. For more on that, we're joined now by Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Jeremy.
And first of all, President Trump said just last month at the CIA, quote, "We should have kept the oil, but okay, maybe you'll have another chance." So who should we listen to, the Secretary of Defense or the President?
Well, this is something that Donald Trump has said going back to an interview he gave in 2011 to the Wall Street Journal, where the subject was Libya, whether the United States should be involved in Libya. And he said, "I've got no interest in Libya unless we take the oil." So it's unclear whether Donald Trump thinks that America should be involved in these battles to take the oil, or as he has said more recently as last month, that it's a reimbursement for the amount of money that the U.S. spends in those countries. So you get a window into his thinking that perhaps he thinks that given how much the war in Iraq has cost, the oil is a benefit. But this is having an effect on the ground because we have very active involvement with Iraq and Iraqi troops and with the Iraqi people. They clearly didn't like that message. So General Mattis went in there and said, "We're not here to seize anyone's oil."
And is that the statement that should be taken seriously from General Mattis saying, "We're not taking the oil"?
That question is above my pay grade, Jeremy. Mm. But the problem is that the U.S. Was and has been very involved in Iraq, and what they'd like is for Iraqi troops to take more of that role. So they have been involved in more training and more support for those troops. So General Mattis's goal is to not have those troops disappear on them, to not have the Iraqi people further turn against U.S. troops in Iraq, and so, you know, finally allow for that push of ISIS out of Iraq. So his reality is if talking about taking Iraqi oil turns people against America, then it's not in his interests.
Well, what about what President Trump has said about ISIS and the oil? He said you wouldn't have ISIS if we took the oil. Explain that connection that he's making. Yeah,
that's actually a more nuanced statement. And there's a lot of truth to that. ISIS is a much more sophisticated organization than Al-Qaeda ever was, largely because Al-Qaeda depended on donations from wealthy individuals and supporters around the world. ISIS actually funds itself. Now, some of that is just from stealing, from seizing banks, from running road tolls and rackets. But a lot of it has been from selling oil in northern Iraq and in northern Syria and smuggling it out of those places. So Donald Trump's point there was that if that oil was not allowed to be taken by ISIS, ISIS would have had a lot more trouble financing itself. Now, increasingly, they've had more trouble selling and smuggling that oil, so ISIS exists even without the same amount of oil they used to have. But the point is well taken.
How important is oil to the economy of Iraq right now, and specifically the Iraqi government?
Oh, it's huge. First of all, it's just useful to know that Iraq is the second largest oil producer in OPEC after Saudi Arabia. It holds 9% of global oil reserves. So this is huge to Iraq. In fact, it's a country that has had its economy otherwise decimated. So this is the majority of its ability to make money. So it's a very, very big deal. 85% of Iraq's oil comes out of southern Iraq, which has nothing to do with ISIS. That's in the control of the government. But about 15% of Iraq's oil is in northern Iraq, and it's controlled by the Kurds, who have autonomy. Iraq doesn't get that money anyway. Bottom line, though, is oil is crucial to the economy of Iraq. If Iraq's ever going to survive on its own, it's got to be able to have that oil and sell it.
And that Kurdish area of Iraq, by the way, is if you hear an American reporter in Iraq,
yes,
usually that's where they are. They're in the Kurdish area because it is the safest area of Iraq.
That is right. And the Kurds in that area have been working in concert with American troops, which again complicates the matter because Iraqis don't necessarily want that to happen either.
And Ali, what about the price of oil overall? We haven't talked about it in a while because it's been kind of around the same place,
yeah,
around $50 a barrel or
yep,
so. But what's going on with oil prices?
Yeah, so it's more around the 53-ish dollar a barrel range. I think that's where it's going to be this week. It was about $45 a barrel for most of 2016. What happened is both OPEC and large non-OPEC producers understood that this was hurting them too much, so they agreed to a production output, and that caused prices to go up. But that also gave an opportunity to U.S. producers who can't really make money on oil when it's $45 or $50 a barrel to start thinking about producing and increasing production. So this is that that delicate balance. I think you're going to see it in the $50 to $60 range for the balance of this year, unless something changes, something notable happens.
Which means gas prices probably stay right around where they
are. Right around where they are, maybe a little bit higher. Remember, we'll expect gas prices to go up at the end of spring anyway, as they normally do, because we change the type of oil we refine,
right,
and it's a more expensive oil.
That's Ali Velshi, anchor and economics correspondent at MSNBC. Ali, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.